Welcome to today's program. My name is Jim Armitage. I'm a professor of medicine at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. Today, I'm joined by Dr. John Leonard, who's a professor of hematology and medical oncology at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York, and Dr. Jason Weston, who's the director of the Lymphoma Clinical Research Program at MD Anderson Cancer Center. Today's presentation will address ways of improving the spectrum of care for patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. In this presentation, I'm going to discuss a few things about classification and treatment advances. I'll make two points that I hope will set the stage for as we go forward. Dr. Leonard will then discuss the most up-to-date data reflecting what's currently working, what's currently used, and generally not considered investigational in the first-line therapy of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And then Dr. Weston is going to discuss new targets and novel therapies that we hope will be tomorrow's first-line therapy for this disease. First of all, I'm going to make two quick points. Number one, it's become increasingly clear over the last couple of decades, as we've learned more and more about the biology of the diseases, that diffuse large lymphoma is not just one disease. In fact, it's not just 10 diseases. It's a mixture of illnesses that we've always treated the same. This is a current WHO classification, and you can see that the divisions are based on morphology, genetic abnormalities, immunohistochemistry, where the tumor originates, and a variety of other characteristics. So these are a lot of different things that we've treated like they were one thing. Now it gets even more complicated because there's been an effort recently to try to make a molecular classification which takes patients that would be in the regular diffuse large B-cell lymphoma category and looking at gene expression patterns, try to lump them together. And as you can see, this leaves us with groups that look like they're related to follicular lymphoma or marginal zone lymphoma or nodular lymphocyte predominant Hodgkin lymphoma or T-cell rich B-cell lymphoma, those with P53 abnormalities, which in most cancers are bad, those that have genetic abnormalities more like CLL, and those that have genetic abnormalities like a variety of things, but including lymphoplasmacytic lymphoma. This is not yet reached clinical care, although there are some studies that are ongoing about it, and there's some hints that it might be useful. Now, what I'm going to do now is hand the mic over to Dr. Leonard, and John's going to talk about frontline therapy for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma.
Well, thank you, Jim, and I want to also thank the organizers for the chance to be part of this very interesting program. As you heard, I'm going to talk a bit about the initial therapy of large cell lymphoma, which really has not changed for a long time, and then now really is evolving. So I think this program is quite timely and important in what we're going to discuss in the next few minutes. So as this audience likely knows, R-CHOP for six cycles has been the standard initial therapy for most patients with large cell lymphoma. There have been a variety of different potential, at least potential, and I say it that way because none of these takes are definitive, but some would argue that in double hit lymphomas, we should treat patients more aggressively. In primary mediastinal lymphomas, we should potentially use an infusional regimen like dose adjusted R-EPOCH. That's also been considered for HIV-associated lymphomas. There are data with testicular lymphoma with concerns for CNS prophylaxis and other settings as well that can be considered, as well as limiting the amount of treatment, the number of cycles of treatment in limited stage patients or in older or frailer patients where we often use the mini R-CHOP. So while R-CHOP has been the backbone for most patients, clinically, many of us have used for certain scenarios, as summarized on the slide, variations on this regimen. So there have been a number of different strategies beyond those kind of tailoring approaches. There have been a number of strategies to try to improve upon therapy, improve upon R-CHOP for six cycles in large cell lymphoma. And I would say that these were initially independent of cell of origin being the subsetting of large cell lymphoma that about 10 years or so ago became quite of interest and potentially important therapeutically, although that hasn't quite panned out as well. So we were independent of cell of origin, moved toward being specific for the cell of origin, and now we're back to being kind of agnostic to cell of origin. So I'll walk you through this in the next couple of minutes. So one agnostic approach has been to say, well, let's give more chemotherapy. Let's use the dose-adjusted R-EPOCH regimen, which adds etoposide, adjust doses over the course of therapy based on tolerability, and is given infusionally, which is obviously more complicated when you have to have central access and treat the patient over 96 hours continually. And so many of you are familiar with this regimen. In the Alliance CLGB, we did a randomized trial comparing dose-adjusted R-EPOCH to the standard R-CHOP approach. And in fact, what we found was that, not surprisingly, dose-adjusted R-EPOCH was more toxic, kind of by design. It's a dose escalation approach, so there were more infections, more cytopenias evident. But unfortunately, there was no benefit therapeutically. No difference in event-free survival, no difference in overall survival. Now, remembering that the vast majority of patients here had kind of run-of-the-mill or standard diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, so we can't quite draw conclusions about some of the subtypes like double hit or primary mediastinum based on this study. But basically, R-CHOP remained the standard after this approach, and the dose escalation of chemotherapy did not prove to be beneficial and certainly not worth the extra toxicity based on this trial. And so that brings us to the cell of origin based approaches. And really going back now over 10 years, we had several groups, largely led by Lou Stout, but others as well, subdividing diffuse large B-cell lymphoma into two major, now these are not the only subtypes, but two major subtypes based on cell of origin, the germinal center and the activated B-cell subtypes. And as you can see on this slide, there are a number of different oncogenic mechanisms associated with these two different subtypes. And these are also connected with a number of different potential targets. So you could potentially say, well, let's give a drug that's going to target one of these pathways and make the treatment work better. And so that has led to a number of studies designed to take the non-germinal center, which is a rough surrogate for the activated B-cell subtype. That's the subtype that does less well, and said, well, why don't we add in a new drug? And there are a number of potential candidates, as on the last slide, that could be added to R-CHOP and try to make R-CHOP work better in that subset where the targeted therapy might make sense biologically. So many of us were very excited about this approach, myself included, and there were a number of different efforts to try to subset large cell lymphoma patients into these at least two groups and to target the addition of a new drug to R-CHOP, specifically in the subgroup where it is most likely to work, and in the case of the ABC or non-germinal center subtype, the type that needs the most help, where the prognosis is the poorest. And so this is one, there are several drugs and several studies that looked at this. This was the Phoenix study that used ibrutinib. Ibrutinib has a rationale in the non-germinal center or ABC subtype of large cell lymphoma for a variety of different reasons. And this was a randomized trial that essentially took patients with non-germinal center and also looked specifically at the ABC defined group as well and randomized them to either placebo R-CHOP on the right or ibrutinib R-CHOP on the left. And the net of this study was quite disappointing. At the end of the day, there was no difference in response rates, no real difference in CR rates, and no difference in event-free survival, which was the primary endpoint. Whether you looked at the entire non-germinal center subtype or the specifically the ABC subtype, as you can see, the outcomes were the same. And so this is was and is disappointing. However, an interesting observation was that in the younger patients, there was a difference, about a 10%, 10, 12% difference between the two groups in younger patients. And this was attributed to the fact that there was more toxicity to the addition of ibrutinib. that toxicity was more pronounced and more relevant in the older patient population, where the net effect of the toxicity overwhelmed any effect on efficacy. And in fact, in the younger patients who were better able to tolerate the therapy, outcomes were improved by the addition of ibrutinib. So this is a subset. It's not a definitive answer to this question, but it does at least lead one to wonder if this approach does have value just in the right patient population who can tolerate it. And in fact, this approach is being studied in different contexts with other BTK inhibitors at the present time. Now, another reason why this approach perhaps hasn't worked is that diffuse large B-cell lymphoma is not as cleanly subdivided into ABC and GCB subtypes. And in fact, there are several groups, again, led in part by Lou Stout and colleagues, that identified a variety of different approaches, or I should say, further subsetting the diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And you see them summarized in the slide. I don't have time to get into the details of this, but the net is that the subsetting of large cell lymphoma into even smaller and smaller pieces of the pie leads one to wonder, are we able to target these even smaller subsets effectively? And the reason why our manipulations or adding of a drug like ibrutinib, looking at a broad class, is that really that's not as targeted as we need to be. We really need to zero in on the subset specifically that can ibrutinib benefit from ibrutinib, and in fact, as an example, and then in fact that these subsets are much narrower than we thought. And so that's another reason why this approach potentially has failed, at least thus far. And then finally, another reason why these strategies of targeting subsets of large cell lymphoma based on cell of origin or something else have failed is that the time to subset the patient, to profile the patient by one or another mechanism to identify what subset they fit in and therefore what trial or what novel agent is appropriate for their subset takes time. And what we've learned is that when you implement steps that take time as part of a clinical trial, that results in a more favorable patient population. It's intuitive. The person that shows up in your emergency room tonight can't wait around for a week to go on a clinical trial, whereas the person who has a relatively good diffuse large B-cell lymphoma who's not sick, it can wait around or can go through the steps to go on a trial. And in fact, the diagnosis to treatment interval correlates with outcomes. These are data from Matt Maurer and the Mayo Group, suggesting that basically trials are enriched for patients with a longer diagnosis to treatment interval because the process of going on a trial skews you toward more patients who can go through those steps. And that raises the idea that perhaps many of these approaches that require a selection criteria to go on the trial, such as a immunohistochemistry or other molecular subsetting, is going to weed out the patients that can benefit the most from a novel approach because those patients may be too sick to go through the process of getting on the trial. And so these are all reasons why, at least thus far, these targeted subsets of large cell lymphoma patients really have not seemed to benefit from these interventions. Again, it may be that the drug doesn't work, it may be that the patient population or the toxicity may not be appropriate, it may be that the disease is just more complicated than we thought, and that our clinical trial strategies have to be able to adapt to the idea that we have to be able to get patients on studies quickly in order to benefit those who are the sickest. So while that all has happened, other approaches, and again, just to summarize, I should say, all of these kind of cell of origin approaches, whether it's bortezomib, ibrutinib, lenalidomide, so far have not been successful. And in the meantime, we have a number of new drugs that have been approved in relapsed large cell lymphoma. And for the most part, these appear to be agnostic to cell of origin. We really don't have good biomarkers to say who's going to respond to CAR T cells, who's going to respond to tafasitamab, selinexor, loncastuximab, bispecifics. These are all drugs that have activity and approvals in recurrent large cell lymphoma. Bispecifics not yet approved, but some think they may be approved in the near future. So that these do not seem, at least for right now, to rely on a molecular subsetting to decide who needs them. Again, maybe that will sort itself out over time, but right now, in the relapse setting, we're acting in an agnostic fashion as to when we apply these drugs, specifically in regard to whether or not a patient has one cell of origin type of lymphoma or another. And then polatuzumab has come onto the scene. And polatuzumab is an anti-CD79B antibody drug conjugate. You're familiar with ADCs now. They get internalized into the cell, drop off their payload, in this case, an anti-tubulin agent. And that essentially has an anti-tumor effect, essentially delivering chemotherapy more specifically to the tumor cells. And this drug was evaluated in single agent studies. The main toxicities include neuropathy and cytopenias. And in recurrent large cell lymphoma, a reasonable percentage, in fact, the majority of patients had objective responses to polatuzumab as a single agent. And this led to its approval in combination with bendamustine rituximab in the relapse setting. And then more relevant to this discussion led to these recent data that have randomized patients to R-CHOP versus polatuzumab, R-CHP, as initial therapy for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma in patients that have International Prognostic Index scores of 2 through 5. And so the idea here is that polatuzumab is swapped in to the R-CHOP regimen, swapped in for vincristine, because again, both drugs cause neuropathy. And the question is really, well, what is the benefit of swapping in polatuzumab for vincristine in this particular setting? And many of you have seen these data. This study was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. This was a group of patients with large cell lymphoma, median age in their mid-60s, mostly, almost all advanced stage disease, generally had good performance status. About two-thirds of them had an elevated LDH. About two-thirds of them also had IPI scores of 3 through 5, so skewed to a higher risk group of large cell lymphoma patients. You can see the germinal center and ABC subtype patients both were included. Very few patients with double hit and triple hit lymphoma, so we can't draw big conclusions about that from this study. So importantly, the toxicity in the font here is small, but that's okay. The toxicity was quite similar, really just a little bit more in the way of infectious toxicity, but importantly, no difference in neuropathy as a result of this. And I think it's important to note that R-CHOP does have meaningful neuropathy as part of it, but that was not worsened by the substitution of polatuzumab for vincristine. And the key primary endpoint of the study, about a 6.5% absolute difference in 24-month progression-free survival. So PFS was improved by swapping in polatuzumab for vincristine in R-CHOP, again, by about 6.5%. However, overall survival is no difference. Now, whether or not this will change over time, whether or not this will never change because we have more effective second-line and beyond regimens, all remains to be seen. But that's an important caveat of this study and something that a variety of people have said, well, you know, these are less compelling because we don't see an overall survival benefit at this point in time. So then, like always, we try to look at subgroups of patients who benefit. And I've used some arrows here to show you where there were some differences. Older patients seem to benefit from the polatuzumab. Men seem to benefit from polatuzumab. Higher risk IPI patients seem to benefit more, as did patients who did not have bulky disease. So again, these are subset analyses that are of interest. Whether or not we change our practice and restrict our use of this drug to subsets of patients, I think is a debatable issue we'll come back to in a second. And then finally, another subset that interestingly seemed to potentially benefit more is that the ABC subtype seem to benefit more from the addition of polatuzumab. So I preface this by saying this was a cell of origin agnostic treatment, But interestingly, there's a subgroup that seems to benefit more, the ABC subtype. So whether or not we may restrict this use to the ABC subtype, I think, is a topic of pretty open debate right now. Again, you can only draw so many conclusions from subgroup analyses in the context of a positive overall study. So what are my takeaways for the implications of this study? Well, this is a positive trial. There was no overall survival benefit, but there was a PFS benefit. So if you can prevent six or so out of 100 patients from relapsing and needing more therapy, that's probably a good thing, particularly since there was generally comparable toxicity between the regimens. There are these subsets as listed here that seem to benefit more. Now again, in the context of an overall positive study, it's debatable whether or not we restrict to these subsets or just use the primary endpoint of the study and that study population as a whole. If you do the math here, you end up saving 1 out of 15 patients from relapse and needing more therapy. And if you look at the cost from a societal perspective, this turns out to be fairly substantial in that you're spending about $1.4 million to prevent one person from relapsing with the same overall survival. And so I think, you know, this is an interesting and debatable issue in some ways, perhaps answered differently if you're thinking about the societal issue as opposed to the patient in front of you who probably wants to do all they can not to relapse, particularly if they have access to a drug and it doesn't add extra toxicity. So to conclude on this study, I think this is a new option for patients, and it's nice to see a new option for patients. In the setting of an overall positive trial, I do focus on this full study population rather than the subgroups, but that's open to debate. And I think if and when that's available in the future, I think I would generally offer and recommend this option to patients if they had the drug available to them. So I just wanted to make one other point about a targeted therapy. This is a little less positive, and this are data, a study that we presented at the ASH meeting in 2021, led by Jeremy Abramson, in the unfavorable double hit lymphoma group of patients. It also looked at the double expressor group. I'm just gonna focus on the double hit group, where we looked at venetoclax, the BCL-2 inhibitor, in combination with either R-CHOP or R-EPOC in either double expressor or double hit lymphomas. And to focus on the double expressor group, what we unfortunately found was that adding venetoclax to dose-adjusted R-EPOC actually worsened outcomes. It worsened progression-free survival and worsened overall survival because of toxicity. So this was obviously quite disappointing that adding a new targeted drug, not surprisingly, added some toxicity, but the fact that this toxicity was significant enough to worsen overall survival really says that we have to be very careful about these toxicity approaches or these toxic agents, despite the fact that they might have a strong rationale. We're still pursuing this with R-CHOP and venetoclax or other data that suggests that that can be safely done, but that's going to really require randomized trials to see what the trade-offs are of adding venetoclax in a subset where that could be beneficial. So to wrap up, I think the key aspects that I would take forward are that we have a variety of different biomarkers. They seem to be of some predictive value, and they seem to be guiding us in some ways to potentially consider the use of certain drugs that may be targeting certain subsets. But these subsets are more and more becoming subclassified even further, that make testing these agents in combination with standard therapies even more and more challenging. Patient selection might be an issue in really clarifying all this, the diagnosis to treatment interval. And really thus far, for a variety of reasons, we seem to be seeing that the most recently impactful drug, polatuzumab, swapped into R-CHOP up front, and then some of the other agents, including CAR T-cells in the relapse setting, right now they are largely agnostic of subset, but I think there's still a lot of work going on to try to sort out further who can benefit the most from these exciting and active new agents. So with that, I'll stop, and I look forward to additional discussion.
So what we're going to do now, since you're a real expert in this, we're going to let you, I'll be like the other people that are watching, asking questions that come up in practice routinely, that what do you do? And so I'm going to ask you several as long as we have time. Okay. As you pointed out, this disease is a moving target in that we're learning more about biology and the names are changing. Are any of those new classification systems, including the more sophisticated ones that you mentioned, the multiple different subtypes, would you direct therapy based on any of those?
Well, I think going back to my earlier slides a little bit, I tend to, the scenarios where I would do something different or I think about doing something different come into the double hit lymphomas and primary mediastinal lymphomas. I'll put aside the CNS prophylaxis issue. I'll put aside the issue of limited stage disease. I think of the scenarios that I think about, the most common ones where I might do something different is primary mediastinal and double hit. Double hit lymphoma, we have lots of data, mostly almost all retrospective, that dose adjusted our EPOC or something more aggressive or something similar, more aggressive than our CHOP does better. I was impressed from the Alliance data that we had that for dose adjusted our EPOC, actually that group of patients did pretty well, actually did better than some of the historical data with double hit lymphoma. Now that may be because, again, the same selection biases of who goes on a prospective versus retrospective study. But that's a scenario where I think there are data all over the place as to whether or not our CHOP is as good as something more or something more is better. But I think the consequences of being wrong about that are that you may be missing out. So in particularly in younger patients that can tolerate a more aggressive regimen, I tend to use dose-adjusted R-EPOC for those patients. But if I have an older patient that can only get R-CHOP, I'm okay with giving them R-CHOP for double hit lymphoma. And then finally, the primary mediastinal group of patients. Again, no randomized data, but as you know, one of the things that we're trying to avoid in primary mediastinal lymphoma, which preferentially affects younger women, is mediastinal radiation and breast radiation and long-term toxicity. And there are some hints that an infusional regimen can probably reduce the chance of having a positive PET scan at the end and needing radiation, which is the clinically relevant part of things. Although that's obviously also a very debatable thing around the world.
You and I do things about the same way. I think I'm agreeing with another thing you said. That is, as you learn more about these new entities and you look more for them, you find out they aren't all necessarily terrible, like localized double hits, or it may be that certainly they're not all the same. Anyway, all right, next thing. EPOCR, you and I would both give it in certain situations. Are there any things other than the standard ones that you just outlined? For example, a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma that looks like a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, but has a greater than 90% proliferative fraction. So it's almost like a Burkitt. Would you use it there? Is there any other situation where you would be tempted to give EPOCR rather than CHOPR?
Well, I would say that we don't have data, or at least I don't know of data that really establishes that. I mean, we looked at, for instance, in the 50303 CLGB study, double expressor lymphoma. It didn't seem to make a difference in that group of patients. I don't know that we had, and that study, for the reasons we talked about, was relatively enriched for more favorable patients. And again, for the same reasons we've talked about, it's hard to get on a clinical trial, and who ends up there tends to be not the sickest patients, so to speak. So I would say even if we looked at that particular issue, and we may have to a limited extent, I don't think we have enough patients of that category to draw a big conclusion. I think the more practical scenario, what you describe, is that you have someone who's sick, who needs therapy, who has a high Ki-67, and you don't have the FISH results back, but we want to get started on therapy. And so in those scenarios, that may be one where I start them on dose-adjusted R-EPOC. I'm suspicious of a double hit, but I don't have the FISH, or I'm waiting for more tissue or whatever as far to get the FISH done. And I might start them on dose-adjusted R-EPOC And depending on how it goes, then, you know, switch them over to R-CHOP based on the laboratory findings and so on. Again, obviously, that's in a patient who I think can tolerate that regimen.
All right, John, there's a bunch of things in our business where interim PET scans are important. Obvious one is a number of situations in Hodgkin lymphoma where it's important. Mostly, we don't have any really good data that you should be doing interim PET scans in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Most of our data is what you are after six cycles of something. Do you ever do them?
Well, I think it's a good question. I think we end up getting them because we end up restaging the patient, and we are generally able to get a PET scan to restage the patient, and you get some more information. So I'm going to generally feel better about a patient that, you know, is PET negative after, say, three cycles if I'm getting it. So I'm getting the scan because I want to restage the patient and see progress. And if I have the choice between a CT and a PET, I'll get the PET just because I like that extra information. That being said, if I couldn't get the CT, I don't think it's clinically, doesn't change my management, let's put it that way. It's pretty rare for a patient to have a positive PET in a new area without something new on a CT scan in the interim stage, that early progressive. First of all, that's rare to begin with. And second, you know, it's normally evident with a new mass somewhere or something else going on. So I would say that I end up getting those interim PETs. I rarely, if ever, change treatment on that basis. Certainly would be doing a biopsy, generally speaking, before I change anything. But I get the information just because it's a little bit more helpful and makes me feel a little bit better. But it's certainly not mandatory for practice for the vast majority of people.
You brought up before CNS prophylaxis. I would guess that the people watching would like to know what Dr. Leonard does for CNS prophylaxis. To whom do you recommend it?
Well, I think how I look at it is, how concerned am I about CNS relapse risk and how well the patient is likely to tolerate prophylaxis, knowing that the evidence for prophylaxis for most settings is quite minimal. Also, what is the downside of not prophylaxing someone who could have benefited from it? So when you roll all that up together, it comes down to the risk of the patient based on the CNS IPI, which is largely the IPI score plus adrenal and renal areas. So that's that to me for most scenarios. In addition, you know, one would add things like testicular involvement, et cetera. Then it's, well, what's the downside of missing something, which is pretty high for most patients. In other words, if the true value of CNS prophylaxis is meaningful and you didn't do it, then the downside of not doing it is significant. And then the other piece of the puzzle is, how well is the person going to be able to tolerate the treatment? So that being said, there's a lot of variability, I would say, in what I do. I think that in most patients that have risk factors, I will do one LP, look for evidence of CNS involvement with flow, and give them one dose of intrathecal methotrexate. I would tend to use systemic methotrexate in patients where they're higher on the risk score, and particularly that they're younger and can tolerate it. So that, you know, how I'm going to approach a frailer older patient is going to be different than a 20-year-old, where, you know, I think getting methotrexate when you're 20 years old, systemic methotrexate, is an easier thing to put up with in obviously certain groups of patients versus others. But that's something I talk with people about. I think we also have data that you can give methotrexate at the end rather than kind of trying to slice it in between the treatments, on day 15. That makes it longer if you give the methotrexate at the end, after the R-CHOP is done. But really, I would say that it really comes down to kind of the stew of all of those factors that I just talked about. and you know where we go from there. So it's not a very easy and straightforward algorithm for me, and I'm guessing for most people in practice, because this comes up very, very often, as you know.
All right, we're pushing the time, but there's one more thing you can answer just real quickly that we talked about earlier and people would probably like to know. You have a person who presented to you with a 10 or 11 or 12 or 15 or 20%, 20 centimeter mass. Do you still use radiotherapy after completing the chemotherapy?
I tend to not use radiotherapy as consolidation after say R-CHOP for bulky diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. I will typically look at those patients and watch them with if their PET is still positive. And the common scenario, very briefly, is that they have a high SUV at the beginning and they have a much lower but not normal SUV afterwards. And those are patients that I might do a follow-up PET scan and just watch for a while, more often than giving radiation. But I know that there are different opinions on that as well.
John, thank you very much. That was a wonderful presentation. I hope everybody else enjoyed as much as I do listening to you analyze different complicated things that come up in the care of these patients. Thank you again.
Thanks very much. It's been a great discussion.
Now, Dr. Jason Weston is going to discuss emerging agents that we hope are the future standard frontline therapy, at least some of them will be, for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, because if that's not true, we're not going to get better and we want to cure more patients. Jason.
Wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Armitage, and thank you, Dr. Leonard, for that great presentation. I'm now going to take over and talk about new targets and novel therapies in the second line for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and beyond, hoping that some of these therapies can move eventually into frontline and improve our standard of care. I'll focus first on CAR T-cell therapies, then I'll talk about signs, bispecific engagers, and lastly, antibody drug conjugates. We have a great problem to have right now in large B-cell lymphoma of an avalanche of new, very promising therapies. The first of which is something called CAR T-cell therapy. And here, the CAR doesn't sound like something you drive. It stands for chimeric antigen receptor. These are a patient's own immune cells, their own T-cells, which are genetically modified to now express a surface molecule that can see an antigen on a tumor target. And here we target CD19. Effectively, these immune cells are weaponized so they can now see the wolf in sheep's clothing, the cancer that's been hiding in plain sight. And these have now been approved in third line therapy. There are three CAR T cells approved for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, but evaluating if they could do better and move into second line therapy, taking on the longtime standard of care of autologous stem cell transplant in patients with chemosensitive disease, we've recently seen three large randomized phase 3 trials, and we'll briefly go through the data that was presented with these three trials. The first of which is the ZUMA-7 clinical trial, which was evaluating axicabtagene ciloleucel, or axi-cel, in comparison to patients with standard of care. Now, these were patients who had prior first-line therapy and had relapsed within 12 months or were refractory and never responded. These patients were randomized 1-to-1 to receive axi-cel or standard of care, and those who responded to standard of care would go in to get a transplant. The primary endpoint was event-free survival. And you can see here in the disposition slide that 94% of patients who were randomized to receive the CAR T-cell therapy axi-cel did so, versus only 36% who were randomized to receive transplant did so, largely due to lack of response to chemotherapy in this highly chemotherapy refractory population. Nearly 3/4 of patients were refractory to their initial treatment, and that showed here with the lack of chemosensitivity. The primary endpoint of this trial showed that axi-cel was superior to standard of care, with a median of 8 months versus 2 months, and at 2 years of 40% versus 16%. A dramatic difference. The median overall survival is an interim analysis, not yet mature, but does show a trend towards the CAR T-cell product here, with an updated presentation earlier this year showing a p-value of 0.015, which is not yet mature enough for final analysis, but stay tuned for that perhaps next year. The overall response rates were significantly better for CAR T-cells, 80% versus 50%, and the complete response rate was more than double, 65% versus 32%. That's the ZUMA-7 clinical trial. Now let's move on to talk about the BELINDA clinical trial. And this is evaluating a different CAR T-cell product, one called Tisagen Leklusal. And this clinical trial is a slightly more complicated design where patients are randomized 1-to-1 to receive the CAR T-cell product or standard of care. But there was a longer manufacturing time here in this trial of about 6 weeks, which is quite a long time for a large B-cell lymphoma patient to wait. And the standard of care arm, if there was lack of response, they would go on to receive a second salvage regimen, effectively a second bite at the apple to try to get to transplant. So the long time to receive the CAR T-cells and a second version of salvage chemotherapy administered gave a few differences in the design for this trial versus the ZUMA-7 trial. Here, the disposition showed that 96% of patients received Tisagen Leklusal versus only 32%, 33% that received transplant. A consistent theme here of these second line trials that despite the intention of going to transplant, a minority of patients actually do receive it. Here, the ability to cross over was embedded in the trial, and more patients on the standard of care arm actually received a CAR T-cell in third line as a crossover. Unfortunately, this trial showed no difference in the event-free survival. Tisagen Leklusal was the same as standard of care, showing no improvement in event-free survival. And this may be due in part to the design features I mentioned, but also due to the relatively poor response of Tisagen Leklusal in this trial. The overall response rate was only 46%, and the complete response rate was only 28%. And I say only because in comparison to what we just heard from ZUMA-7, and what I'll show you in a moment about the other randomized trial, these numbers are not as good as we would have expected for a CAR T-cell product. The third and final randomized phase 3 trial looking at an autologous CAR T-cell is the TRANSFORM study. This is evaluating lysocell or lysocaptogene maraleucel in comparison to the same standard of care approach of salvage chemotherapy followed by a transplant in patients who do respond or cross over to lysocell after one salvage regimen with lack of response. Here, the disposition showed a consistent theme that 97% of patients received the CAR T-cell versus 47% received the transplant. The primary endpoint of event-free survival showed a significant improvement in event-free survival of 10 months versus 2 months in the experimental arm of lysocell versus standard of care. And the response rates are also dramatically better for the CAR T-cell, 86% overall response rate, 66% complete response rate in comparison to the standard of care high-dose chemotherapy arm. Overall survival is quite immature in this data set, which to date only has 6 months of median follow-up, so difficult to interpret, but perhaps there could be an early separation of the curves with additional data to follow up. So, in cross-trial comparison, we have a lot of historical trials evaluating high-dose chemotherapy with an intention for transplant, and then we have these three new randomized phase 3 trials looking at CAR T-cells. The three new studies had an enrichment for refractory patients, so these were a highly chemotherapy refractory group with either no response to first-line treatment here as refractory or at best still progressing within 12 months. The complete response rate on these trials, the new phase 3 randomized ones, in my mind, lines up generally with what we've seen in historical trials with a complete response rate of around 30% for all the standard of care chemotherapy arms. In contrast, the two CAR T-cells that performed well in these studies showed almost a doubling of complete response rate in the mid-60s. So we have two-thirds of patients responding complete response to CAR T versus one-third responding completely to chemotherapy. And then receiving the transplant in these studies, 30 to 40% received transplant. That's not too different from what we've seen historically. So these trials, the standard of care arm performed as well as it could, but the CAR T-cell arm outperformed it, and therefore the new standard of care, in my opinion, is to consider a CAR T-cell of axi-cel or lysocell for patients who are early relapsed or refractory from frontline treatment. Further supporting that is that quality of life data is now being presented from a couple of these trials showing that the patients who received axi-cel had an earlier return to their quality of life pre-treatment and actually an improvement in quality of life over their baseline versus the standard of care patients had a longer time to recover. So not only is it more effective, but patients' quality of life appears to be improved based on these CAR T-cell data. So in summary, CAR T-cells cure more patients. The randomized phase 3 trials do line up with historical data and the standard of care arms. More patients on the standard of care arms actually received a third line CAR T-cell than they did transplant. And I think quite provocatively for our field, at 2 years, despite an intensive chemotherapy program, only 16% of patients on the ZUMA-7 clinical trial with median follow-up of 24 months were event-free, implying that we are giving high-dose chemotherapy historically to these patients, and one out of six patients are receiving long-term benefit. That's not great. So I would argue, why save our best therapy for third line? And in my practice, CAR T-cells have now moved into second line for these early relapsing patients. Moving on to the next subjects, the selective inhibitors of nuclear export are led by this compound called selinexor. This is a clever idea of blocking a nuclear export protein, which effectively traps tumor suppressors within the nucleus, which preferentially should be toxic to cancer cells. And selinexor was evaluated in the SADDLE trial, which was a single-arm phase 2 study. And the eligibility criteria for this trial were somewhat unique in that patients were required to either have a complete or partial response and have had 60 days elapsed since their most recent therapy, or if they didn't have a complete response, have to have waited 14 weeks since their most recent therapy. That is not a hyperproliferative group. That's a relatively slow-growing version of large B-cell lymphoma. And the consort diagram shows that this is a subset of a subset that we're analyzing here. 200 some odd patients were initially enrolled, but the primary efficacy was at a certain dose level, and that only was 127 patients that were evaluable in this trial. This was approved by the FDA based upon these response rates, with an overall response rate of 28% and a complete response rate of 11.8%. Now that seems relatively low. However, for those patients who did achieve a complete response, their duration of response median was 23 months. So there is a subset of patients who do extremely well with this selinexor approach, an oral agent, which may be attractive for those that aren't wanting to receive IV therapy or travel to a specialized center. Moving on to what I think is an exciting new advance, not yet approved by the FDA, but I'd say stay tuned because this will change soon, are the bispecifics, the so-called bispecific antibodies. And the original shot on goal in this field was an antibody called blinatumomab targeting CD19 and CD3, but the new emerging kids on the block are targeting CD20 and CD3. And I'll highlight three of these today, epcoritamab, mosunetuzumab, and glofitamab. Glofitamab is slightly unique in that it has two antigen-binding epitopes for CD20 and one for CD3. The others are one and one of CD20 and CD3. The first data set to explore is epcoritamab in the EPCOR trial, targeting patients with relapsed or refractory large B-cell lymphoma. What's common to all three of these bispecific antibodies is a way to try and mitigate toxicities, including cytokine release syndrome, is a step-up dosing, starting off with a very low dose, then a medium dose, and then the full dose to try and effectively temper cytokine release syndrome by gently exposing the patient to the drug over time. Epcoritamab is treatment until progression or unacceptable toxicity. And in this cohort, the patients, 61% were primary refractory and 20% had prior CAR T-cell therapy. And here are the results. It's a very impressive overall response rate of 63% and a complete response rate of 39%. You can see the waterfall plot. The majority of patients derive clinical benefit. And on the left-hand side, the swimmer's plot shows that the durability of responses appears to be very promising, with many patients now more than 30 weeks on study. Again, still on treatment until progression, but nonetheless, this in this refractory population appears very attractive, and many studies are ongoing evaluating this bispecific. The next bispecific to review is glofitamab, and in this clinical trial looking at glofitamab monotherapy, the step-up dosing, as we've heard before, and up to a total of 12 cycles of therapy, so a fixed duration of therapy. Patients on this trial had refractory disease to their most recent treatment of 86%, and 30% were refractory to prior CAR T-cell treatment. And here are the results, an overall response rate of 52%, complete response rate of 39%, and the duration of overall response now at 18 months, duration of complete response not yet reached. Now granted, patients are on treatment for 12 cycles or about 9 months, so the time will tell what will happen is patients who are off therapy. What is their long-term response? Are we seeing a plateau, or are these patients having late relapses? We don't yet know, but there are hints there may be patients who remain in remission for a durable time after treatment. And then lastly, mosunetuzumab and polatuzumab polatuzumab, we'll talk about the next section, an antibody drug conjugate, step-up dosing, concurrent doublet therapy here of mosunetuzumab and polatuzumab in patients with 40% prior CAR T-cell therapy, showed a very impressive waterfall plot with an overall response rate of nearly 60%, a little bit above 60%, and a complete response rate in the 40% range, both in CAR T naive and CAR T-cell relapsed patients. Very impressive combination here in this hard to treat patient population. So lastly, moving into the antibody drug conjugates, we heard probably a little bit about this from Dr. Leonard in his talk, including the Polarix trial. Polatuzumab vedotin is an anti-CD79B antibody drug conjugate and was originally approved based on a trial led by Dr. Lori Sen and colleagues, randomizing patients to receive either polatuzumab with bendamustine rituximab or bendamustine rituximab alone, 40 patients per arm. And these were the results, a dramatic difference between the two groups for progression-free survival and notably for overall survival, leading to additional studies, including that Polarix trial. So this is certainly a live option for patients in third line therapy today. Loncastuximab tesirine is another antibody drug conjugate recently approved by the FDA for third line plus for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, targeting CD19. And here there are two cycles of a higher dose, kind of a loading dose, if you will, and then patients drop down to 75 micrograms per kilogram and can continue therapy for up to 3 years based upon the schedule shown here on the screen. On the LOTIS-2 trial, the overall response rate was around 48%, complete response rate of around 25%. And you can see this unique dimer that's added, the PBD dimer. This is not something that we typically see with the other antibody drug conjugates, often using MMAE technology. PBD is a unique dimer, which has unique toxicities to learn about if you're going to use this therapy. But the reason you may want to use it is the responses do appear to be quite promising, with many patients deriving benefit lasting more than 6 months. And then lastly, not an antibody drug conjugate, but one I wanted to mention nonetheless, because it's also a CD19 targeting agent, tafasitamab. This, in combination with lenalidomide, the immunomodulatory drug, has been evaluated in the L-MIND trial, which led to FDA approval in second line plus therapy for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Here, the overall response rate was 60%, with a complete response rate of 40 plus percent in patients with heavily pretreated disease. The schema is shown here on the slide. And with an update to the responses, we now are seeing patients who've achieved a complete response having a median duration of response not yet reached, but many patients are now more than 3 years out without a progression event, implying the possibility that some of these patients may not have disease anymore, that perhaps they could in fact be cured, not with the cell therapy-based approach, which would be a remarkable advance for our field. So in conclusion, we have a great problem. We have an incredible number of promising therapies in development or approved. And now our challenge in the next era is how to sequence these therapies, how to select patients for a specific therapy. And I would argue the biggest challenge is how to successfully combine these treatments going forward and to change practice for our patients. Thank you very much for your attention.
Jason, thank you for that wonderful, concise, clear presentation. And I have a few questions for you. I'm just going to run through several of them. And I'm actually really quite interested to hear what you think. Outside of a study, do you have a particular approach that would match up to a certain group of patients, either biologically or clinically, or do you have in your mind, now we're talking salvage therapy, which group for which patients? What groups require a particular approach?
I think to me, the salvage approach that would line up with a particular group are in those chemo refractory patients, those that never responded to initial treatment. We now know with these large randomized trials that more chemotherapy is throwing good money after bad. It doesn't work. If a patient is refractory to frontline treatment, they will very likely not respond to second line chemotherapy. And that's a big unmet need because not a lot of our patients will have access to CAR T cells quite yet. CAR T cells are administered at specialized centers. So although I argue that is the new standard of care for those patients, for patients who can't reach a CAR T cell or have a difficult time doing so, we clearly need to have better options than platinum-based chemotherapy for those that are refractory to initial disease. And the clinical trial I just showed for L-MIND, looking at tafasitamab and lenalidomide, actually did not enroll patients who were primary refractory. That was an eligibility exclusion. And so we don't yet have a great standard option in second line for those who are not going to be able to get to a transplant despite intention because of being refractory to chemotherapy. And I think some of the agents we just talked about, the new promising ones, including the bispecifics, have great potential to expand our ability to treat those patients with a targeted approach.
Thank you. Are bispecifics going to replace CAR T-cell therapy?
I don't think that they will. CAR T-cells have a durable response, which is now evaluated out as long as 5 years, showing that about 30-some percent of patients who receive a CAR T-cell for what was a refractory patient population are likely cured, in my words at least, cured of their diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Now, 30% is not as good as we'd like, but many of those patients would not have been alive anywhere close to 5 years if CAR T-cells didn't exist. Bispecific therapies have some advantages in that they're off the shelf and the toxicities may be a little bit less or a little bit more predictable, but they are still requiring an expert management strategy of how do you deal with cytokine release syndrome. And that may be a challenge in the community for this to have a widespread adoption. Plus, we don't yet know if patients who achieve a complete response to a bispecific are eradicated from their disease. Is their disease eradicated? Or is it just suppressed in the way that we've seen with some other targeted therapies and may eventually relapse? So if we had a scenario where we had a plateau for a bispecific treatment that was in the ballpark of what we see for CAR T cells, then perhaps we would see a shift. But I think for now, knowing that patients can be cured with CAR T cells, that's a pretty strong argument that if you had them both on the table and had to pick one, most people who have access to both would say that CAR T cells would be the preferred option. Bispecifics perhaps fix that by jumping ahead of CAR T cells and moving into frontline therapy. And perhaps that could be a reality in the coming years. But I think as of now, the durability of response would be the deciding factor for me.
All right. Showing that you don't forget about old things, which one of these patients that you treat with one of these new therapies should also get radiotherapy?
We think that radiotherapy still plays a role, especially for patients that have very bulky disease. There's always a concern that the tumor penetrance of the treatment is not great if there's necrosis or poor blood flow. And so I still, in my practice, do use radiotherapy for people that have a bulky site of disease. Obviously, the other considerations would be for someone who has a testicular diffuse large B-cell lymphoma to irradiate the contralateral testicle. And then select situations for somebody who had a mediastinal large B-cell lymphoma and receive a CHOP-based regimen. Sometimes we'll use radiotherapy for folks who are going for CAR T-cells as a bridging strategy. So radiation treatment still does play an active role in large B-cell lymphoma here in 2022.
And finally, Jason, are there any people today with these, you just reviewed a bunch of hopeful approaches, who you still should recommend, your recommendation would be palliative care rather than going this route?
Well, certainly the patients who are very elderly, very frail, very unfit, it's a difficult situation for newly diagnosed disease and for relapse disease. Many of these treatments appear very promising, but they do have the potential for side effects. And there's a population of frontline patients who, based upon geriatric assessments, may not be fit to receive chemotherapy. There's been a lot of clinical trials trying to evaluate that space, taking some of these great therapies from relapsed disease settings and trying to evaluate them in frontline therapy, including bispecifics or antibody-drug conjugates, looking specifically at that quote-unquote chemo-unfit or chemo-frail patient population. So as of now, some of those patients might be recommended for palliative care. I don't think that'll be the case in the coming years if we can use some of these relatively non-toxic targeted therapies and achieve good long-term responses.
A wonderful presentation and a fun discussion. I want to thank all of our listeners and watchers to this program. I hope that you gain from it like I did. And thank you very much.